Lyons. I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota with my husband Scott, and we have four kids. They're out here with us too. I'm not sure. Scott might fall asleep. I told him I have jokes like that.
I can warn him.
We're checking it, yeah.
Not really his thing, but I teach at Augustana College there in Sioux Falls, and as I mentioned last night, this area of American women regionalists who are writing primarily near the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th is not something that I've had an opportunity to teach much on, although it is an area that I love. And so when Paul asked if I would come out here, I thought, yes, and I know just what I'll do because I never get to teach these great women writers that are largely overlooked when we do American literature survey courses and those kinds of things. So I appreciate your interest here, and I'm going to try not to repeat too much for those of you who were here last night, but actually let's do introductions first. And let's just introduce yourself and say where you're from. We'll just start there.
Dick Barry Davis, and I'm here because my wife says it was a great lecture.
Oh, good.
Judy Barry Davis. I don't know where I'm from. Marsha Foxman, Minnesota.
Susan Highland from Atlanta, Georgia.
Kata Schwein from Northfield, Minnesota.
Don Rasmussen from Rochester, Minnesota.
Nan Peters from Rochester, Minnesota.
Scott Boyd from Sioux Falls. Bill Davies from Parkland, Washington, Minnesota.
So, what I would have you think about first of all today is I guess I'm working under the assumption that most people who come to Golden are travelers and get some money, and that's partly why I sort of fashioned my theme for the week on traveling, but also because it has to do tremendously with what these women writers are doing in terms of presenting a particular region to readers who may not have the opportunity to travel, but can travel vicariously through reading their stories of whatever region in the United States these authors are from. What I would have you think about,
I'm sorry.
You're fine. But I would have you, yeah, go ahead, tell us who you are.
Renee Geiger, Phil Soames.
Tucson, Arizona. Okay.
Oh, that's a
shame. Is that a boring afternoon?
Do I?
So I would have you just for a moment think about a time when you were traveling and you had an off the beaten path experience. When you got lost, or you traveled off of sort of the, you put through, tossed the guidebook out the window and went somewhere that wasn't included there or something. Just think for a moment about that kind of experience. And then if there's anybody who can share an off the beaten path experience, that's that.
We had an interesting one in Alaska, and we were on a cruise, and each time the ship dropped us off, we didn't stay on the front street where all the tourist stuff is. We always went further back. We were in, which place?
Your story.
Skagway. We were in Skagway. And we started to walk through the town, and all of a sudden this woman walked out from one of the houses, and she started walking with us and telling us about the town and about who lived here and who lived there, and what asked us what our interests were. She said, well, then you'll enjoy the museum. It's down the street. So we were kind of expecting that there would be a handout at the end of all of this, because she was with us for over a half hour. And we told her we'd like to go to the museum. She said, okay. She said, that's down that street. I'm going this way. So then when we got back to the main street that she had walked down, we asked one of the shop owners. This woman came out and just told us these interesting stories about the whole town. She said, yes, that's Annie. She has Alzheimer's. She can remember the past. She was born and raised there. She can remember the past. But she said every day she introduces herself to me. So it was just...
So
experience would you have had staying with all the other doors?
She relates the past and produces.
Every day she does that, and meets new people in the process.
They won't remember you tomorrow.
No, most likely she would not.
That, and that's an interesting commentary on regionalism too, as some of us talked about last night. One of the characteristics of regionalism is that it's nostalgic, that it remembers the past, that it looks back to at a time when modernization and industrialization is changing the world that these writers know so rapidly. They are looking back to sort of simpler times when they knew everybody, you know, on the street and that kind of thing. So, yeah. Other off the beaten path experiences.
Well, we went to Sicily with our neighbors who were both born and raised in Sicily, in Liguri, an island that's off the coast. And so we stayed with our friend's sister, who lived in this house that was connected to a huge chapel with where the walls were 3 feet thick. And the kitchen was just nothing. It was like one spigot and like a stone sink, and the stove was nothing. And I mean, it was so rustic and so primitive. And yet, the fun we had, you know, it all had to be translated. But I don't know, their joy, they're so out there, you know, Italians, Sicilians are, and they love you like a familia, and they've been to each other. And I don't know, I just remember this moment of sitting around the table, it was very simple spaghetti, and they put a bottle of Coke and a bottle of wine in the middle of the table. But then at the end, they had this huge wedge of cheese and this fresh fruit and this bread, and it was just like, I'll never forget that meal. Mm-hmm. It was one of the best ones I've had. And the culture and how warmly we were welcomed for being friends of a relative. Mm-hmm. It would have been this little balcony that was sort of half falling off, and you thought, do I go out on it and overlook the sea, you know? And so.
Yeah, so that sense of welcome that you get, yes, being sort of drawn into a culture and included, even if it's only for one meal.
Yes. And the simplicity of it that was so wonderful,
mm-hmm,
too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any other?
A number of years ago, I went to the Compton Choir of St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral in Seattle, in St. Petersburg, because the cathedral and churches in St. Petersburg had a close relationship. We thought we were going to sing for the rededication of a Lutheran church that had been turned into a swimming pool. But turns out they were nowhere near ready. But the favorite experience we had was that we were housed in an Orthodox seminary, which we could be as a religious delegation, although we couldn't sing in an Orthodox church because we were Orthodox. And in that cemetery were buried every Russian composer I ever heard of.
Oh, wow.
So we sang a Kiev chant with the memorial words in that location.
So that's an unexpected discovery when you come around the corner. We felt that way when we traveled in Italy too, but it seemed like every time you came around the corner, it would open up into something you did not expect.
Ancient.
Or going to visit a church and having a choir and singing while you're visiting
right,
that.
Right.
Okay.
So as you think about those experiences of being pulled off the beaten path or just sort of finding yourself suddenly off the beaten path, how does that affect your understanding of the place that you're in?
Tenfold. What we've done recently fits in, but we, Beth and I and my oldest have just recently traveled to Israel and Palestine, spent 10 days in Palestine instead of the other side. And so we were off the beaten path for most of the time and got to see a lot of stuff that
supposed to be. But a boat came by and he grabbed, they wouldn't let us on the boat, but they towed us. Which was just lucky we didn't get bit by jellyfish, but we did get a tow back anyway. But that could have been kind of exciting.
Right. Well, and that notion of risk, I mean, you're talking about physical risk, but what about personal risk? When you're out there eating that, is there risk involved?
Well, cows, I don't think there would be.
Well, sure. But I mean, even for you to enter into somebody's home, I mean, you risk a part of yourself, or you risk.
Well, you have to be open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And accepting whatever happens.
Yeah.
All right. I'm just thinking, I'm going to Tanzania in about a month, and I'm thinking, I cannot wait to go, and I'm open completely, but there are risks, of food and water and mosquitoes and things, and I wish somebody would just not tell me about it.
Right.
Arusha. But it's all I hear a lot about Lomatil.
Yeah. But I think there is something to risking ourselves when we get off the beaten path and are forced or invited to encounter another that we wouldn't ordinarily encounter. Right? And so in a lot of ways, that's what these regionalist writers were trying to do, was to take us off the beaten path and into homes and into places where, as a reader, you are, invited more than forced, but invited to encounter another person that up until that point in time had not really been represented in literature at all, right? And as someone was talked about again last night, that these are farm wives and wives of seafaring, people, and women who have been living on their own their whole lives, or just sort of the unwritten stories. And so these writers are inviting us into that. So regionalism is trying to show us the local scene by inviting us into homes, into neighborhoods, into families, rather than standing. I just sat in on Janet and Russ Linklater's session last time when they were talking about the objective observer that a journalist is called to be, right, as opposed to having empathy and being in relationship with the thing that you are observing. So local color writers of the time, the Mark Twains, the Bret Harts, the Hamlin Garlands, who are all fine writers, were trying to write more out of that objective reporter kind of style. And these women are saying, well, that's all kind of grand, but what about relationship, right? What about feeling? I wrote my master's thesis about something that I think women at this time are dealing with, which is heart vision, right? Seeing with your heart rather than seeing with just your eyes and connecting in that way. So there's a focus on empathy rather than ridicule. It's so easy, right, when you see somebody who's different from you to point a finger and say, well, that's strange and funny and isn't that weird, right, as opposed to going into their home and having a meal and you can no longer do that. Ridicule anymore. You have to become, you're invited to become empathetic with that. The other thing that regional writing does is that it focuses on character more than plot, which was a significant shift at this time in writing, where it was primarily plot driven. And so what if we just focus on character and just get to know these people and nothing really happens much? You just kind of get to know people. It's like having a conversation. Today we're going to look at a piece by Sarah Orne Jewett, who is the writer who's most commonly associated with regional writing. She is from Maine, and her writing takes place in Maine. And this is a story from a collection of hers called Deep Haven, which is a collection of sketches about this fictionalized, but maybe not so fictionalized, town in Maine. And this particular story happens, or comes in the center of this collection. So oftentimes I think when we look at the center of a piece of literature, we think that is a pivotal point, that it's an important moment, and we should be able to pay a little attention to it if it's in the middle. And so I'm going to tell you a bit of the story, and then I'm going to give you a piece of it to read, and then we'll talk about that. So the narrator of the story is visiting the town Deep Haven with her friend Kate, and they are hanging out with an older woman named Mrs. Q, and Mrs. Q knows all the town, and she knows everybody in it, sort of like the woman that you met on the street in Alaska, and so she knows everybody's backstories. And on this, in this particular story, the circus at Denby, they have decided to go to a circus. It has been years since the circus has come anywhere near Deep Haven, and they're very excited to be able to attend the circus. And so for it, the funny thing about the story is that almost half of the story is about getting to the circus. Right? And so they're on their way to the circus, and they're visiting with people along the way. Visiting is a huge trope for Sarah Orne Jewett. For her, visiting is that is the way of being, you visit. And so they're visiting with people along the way, and she's introducing the narrator and her friend Kate to all these people, and of course she has everybody's backstory, and they run into a family where the father has suddenly, you know, become ill on the street, and these poor children, now they don't get to go to the circus because their father's too sick to take them, and she gives them their whole backstory. And then they finally get to the circus, and they sit down for the big tent show, and it's totally disappointing. It isn't at all what they had hoped it would be, right? I mean, and isn't that always the way, that our imagination is much, much better than the reality. The animals are tired and, you know, look underfed, and like circuses always are. Take their kids to the circus because I can't stand to watch them. I just think they're pitiful. And that's how this one is. And so what they end up doing is watching the people in the crowd more than the show, right? And isn't that what we often do? And again, Mrs. Q is telling them about, oh, there's so-and-so over there and over there, and gives them the whole story. So it really becomes about connecting with the people. But it's also an interesting story about spectacle. And the gaze, right? That when you're watching a spectacle, or when you're in observance of something, sort of what happens to you, and does that change you in any way? And what is your responsibility as the looker on of the spectacle? They leave the circus tent, and they're walking along, and they. They travel off the midway, off the beaten path, and they duck into a sideshow tent. And that's where the story picks up. And I will let you, it goes on both sides, so, and we may have to share a little bit. I'll give you guys time. So if you're willing to look on this, so that would be great. And I'll just let you read that, and then make your observations along the way, and we'll talk.
This was a series of books?
This is a series of sketches that are collected in a book called Deep Haven.
I
sideshow, free shows were really popular. And they're sort of part of that, they come out of that growing middle class that's happening at that time, and then the need to, the middle classes need to differentiate themselves. And so freak shows are a way for people to say, well, I'm not that. And as I mentioned last night, some of the writing of that time was intended to have that same sort of effect, to show you the freak show so that you could feel better about yourself. And so the question is that what Judith is doing here? Is she showing us a freak show so we can feel better about ourselves, or is she doing something different? What struck you in this passage?
Empathy for the lady who used to be somewhat different.
And how is that empathy conveyed?
We didn't usually talk to the freak. You just look at them, or you talk about them, right?
Yeah.
Sort of like
in front of them.
In front of
them,
yeah. Right. And so that was surprising to me in the story.
Sort of the same way that we do with when we confront a homeless person. You know, thank goodness I'm not that. And then you find out it's who we are. I mean, it can happen to kinds of people.
When you hear the story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Right. If you actually talk to.
So it does seem to be something different going on here. Are there elements of it that, however, that strike you as ridicule or as a, I'm not her?
Well, she did distance herself afterwards to her friend. She said, well, yeah, I didn't really know her that well. She lived a long ways away, and she used to be this horrible, fighty. So it was a way of saying, yeah, she had problems then too. She still has problems, but she had problems then too.
So there is a reluctance or a resistance to fully entering into the relationship with her.
Well, yeah, she would have sunk the dory.
Exactly.
The dock is left.
That's small boat.
Yeah, and there is sort of this humor, a moment of laughing at her, really, right, in that. And so, and that is in some ways indicative of the regionalist's dilemma, right? Presenting people with sympathy and empathy, and yet knowing that as the writer, that there is necessarily some distance, right? And is it a betrayal to present the Kentucky Giantess as the Kentucky Giantess, right? Or is that just truth?
And it was an exchange. You felt like they were actually helping the Giantess out because she felt better having seen them. She felt like she was human again. And then at the same time, they felt worse afterwards themselves.
Yeah.
So there's that exchange that they made her feel better, but they felt worse.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Until they then got over it and got to be married again.
Yeah. So there's an exchange of conversation, but also just an exchange of feelings, right? Mm-hmm. Trading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had paid money in order to go see people being exploited.
Although,
how much exploitation is it when that's the only means you have for being reasonably alive.
Yeah. Right.
I think there were also real indications of saying, I wouldn't want to live if I weighed any more than this now.
Mm-hmm.
And also that Kate said, I could tell by looking into her eyes that she'd lost all the spiritedness that she had before, that flightiness or whatever. But so there's real empathy with the despair, I think, of being in the position that she was in.
And there is something about looking into the eyes, right? That there's an exchange of the gaze. The gaze becomes this mode of power in this period, and really on through. There are critical theorists who talk structure of the film. We really have ultimate power over what we're seeing on the screen because we are the gazers. And the same would be true when you go to a circus. Like, you have all the power because we are doing the watching. And
you said in a sense that the socialization too, that she was all this negative stuff, and then she's also really vicious, but now she's calmed down.
Yeah.
And yet she lives a life of adventure and travel and sees new. So she said to herself that she likes part of that traveling around and lots to think about. And so there's some good things in her new life too. And her reference to wishing she had a daughter, but she had a daughter, but she lost her.
Mm-hmm.
You got kind of that impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
maybe more caring, maybe. It's being an object, though. It's objectification of a human being, the way the circus is all object, and how that would feel.
Yeah.
And even to talk about her as though she were not a human being there,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Right.
Is Mrs. Q sort of a reliable narrator of these people?
Yeah.
So
she's
pretty,
reliable.
Like, because it does seem. It's kind of unclear whether, like, the giantess has a pretty good deal going on. I mean,
it's
because
good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, it seems very balanced in terms of. She gets taken out of the situation,
mm-hmm.
and he's raised her pay, and she's getting to travel, and the way that Mrs. Q describes her, if she's reliable, is that she was kind of horrible before, and that somehow she seems, so when she says she used to be a dreadful, flirty, high-tempered girl, but she's lost that now,
mm-hmm.
I can see by her eyes.
But that reflects her attitude about what is proper for women to act like.
Right, but I'm wondering whether, if we're supposed to be sad about that or not, like,
mm-hmm.
if she has,
mm-hmm.
has she...
Her spirit's been crushed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are we supposed to read it as her spirit's been crushed, or are we supposed to read it as, like, she was kind of... she was, right, I mean,
she's
dreadful, flighty, high-tempered, and
yeah.
she chilled out a little bit,
right?
I mean, like,
yeah,
if
no,
Mrs.
No.
Q is to be believed, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't
so
know.
So, well, it's mixed. It can be bad that she's lost it, but it also can be good that she's lost it,
right.
but she's better socialized, and
right.
she's along with people better.
Right, because, I mean, my first instinct is to, of course, feel like, oh, this giantess must be this object, and we should feel awful, and but... And there's moments of that, but she does a really interesting job of making it kind of unclear. I mean, like, if you as the reader could take the giantess out of this situation, like, would you? I don't know if I would.
That's an excellent question.
Because what kind of life would she have?
Right, right. She's 400 pounds.
Right,
yeah, that's what she knows is traveling with the circus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think to follow up on that question, Would we as the reader be able to have this conversation about the Kentucky Giantess if Jewett didn't give us her story?
Right.
If they saw the sign and they said, oh, we'd love to see this 600-pound woman, and they went in and they said, oh, she's not really 600 pounds, that's just as disappointing as the show we just saw under the big tent, let's leave. Right? No conversation. We couldn't even have this conversation about her and what is best for.
Well, then an element of surprise too. You're in this setting where you wouldn't at all expect to see someone you knew, and here she knows her, and it's like it makes the circus more involved in ordinary life because this is somebody who was in ordinary life
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It strikes me. Thinking about the movie last night, I don't know if other people went to see A Time for Burning, but it was the documentary on the church in Omaha. And the crux of the crisis was the counselor, the outreach ministry, was suggesting that people from this white congregation, that they choose 10 families to go have dinner with 10 African-American families from the church 3 blocks away. And that was the proposal. And it completely shut the church down over its radical nature, that they thought it was just too threatening that these people meet and have dinner and have conversation, and the radical nature of just knowing someone or listening to someone's story. And it strikes me that the fact that they Association sort of changed that whole, that was a radical act.
Yes.
So they left, she felt better, right? So you have this disparity and she felt better and they felt worse. So sort of, you know.
It balances the scale in some way or,
yeah,
or, and that's empathy, right? Taking on somebody else's suffering, really, right?
Yeah. And at the same time, they still have the sense that they're better off than she is.
Yes.
They went to the circus, they saw, they come away thinking, oh, not us.
Right.
And we too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Say more about that, what do you, as the reader?
As the reader, you identify with these visitors,
mm-hmm.
and I think you take their side.
Mm-hmm.
You're drawn into their side, whether it's a conscious thing or not, but in storytelling, you become a participant, not a spectator.
Mm-hmm. Right. But are we drawn into the shoes of the Kentucky Giantess at all?
Yeah.
Mm.
Or do we remain? And we're in the tent, right? So we at least have crossed the threshold.
And the two are looking at the monkeys. They don't want to even get close enough to see that it's a person.
Yeah, and why? What are Kate and the narrator uncomfortable about? Because they are sort of just listening to the conversation between Mrs. Q and the giantess.
Mrs. Q was one of the issues. They were feeling that they wanted her to have a good time, and she hadn't had any earlier chance. So letting her go in was doing something for her, but they weren't really in on it. It was really for her, so she can go look at that lady. But they were just going to stay over here and let her do that.
Because why? What are they uncomfortable about?
I think it's because probably the sideshow was more of a lower class thing.
To attend in the first place,
and they felt themselves to be above that, so they weren't the kind of people who would go to a sideshow.
Okay.
But because they were with Mrs. Q, who wanted to go, then they felt kind of obliged to, you know, to go along with her.
Okay.
That's my sense of it.
I think there is an element of that, certainly, that it's not proper for them to be in there in the first place. Are there other emotions that seem to come up for them?
I would think, and I really was drawn into the fact that maybe her life could have been worse if she weren't, you know, in the circus. But
yeah.
I think to engage someone in a freak show is something that most people would not do, whether they knew them or not.
Yeah.
You are engaging the other.
You're in the audience too, and there's a stage versus audience thing.
Yeah. And I don't think the way when we see some homeless people, we do not think of engaging them, or we see someone who, you know, whatever it is. And so I would think that there, I forgot your question, but I was thinking about the life and whatever. I would imagine it would have been a lonely life for the giantess.
Mm-hmm.
Not truly seen as human, maybe as a human being.
Yeah.
Although she got travel and food in Washington.
She certainly benefits from.
Yeah, and she wasn't as big as an eater as the earlier one, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
She has a certain standard to maintain. She needs to eat at least enough to maintain.
Right.
Her physical needs were being met.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
Her spiritual needs or her, you know.
Are not. Until sort of this moment. And then so we have the lifting of her spirit.
Yeah.
It is possible to identify with the giantess as well,
mm-hmm.
and particularly when there's that shift, and then the poor giantess lost her professional look and tone, as she said, "I believe I'd rather die than get any bigger."
Mm-hmm.
I do lose heart sometimes, and I wish I was a smart woman and could keep house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, oh, well, maybe
there's some of that yearning.
But the way her life was, would it ever have been the ultimate of what she wanted,
mm-hmm.
with her father? I can't remember now anymore, but she had a kind of a rough life.
Mm-hmm.
She may not have been able to keep house and have a husband and all that.
So is she any more of a sideshow in the circus than she was to take great care to avoid coming off as gossip, right? When you're telling the stories of the locals, isn't that gossip, right? Did you feel like the woman who was talking to you on the street in Alaska was gossiping, or was she just giving you information?
She was giving us facts.
Yeah.
So-and-so lived here, mm-hmm. This is what they did.
Mm-hmm.
Her father had been one of the
founders
of the
town.
So at what point does story cross over into gossip?
There you go. You have a lot of writers whose families are very unhappy with them. They've written about it in their fiction.
I think if a sentence starts with "I have heard,"
mm-hmm.
you're going to assume it's
yeah.
But if it's out and out fact, then it's not.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's also the tone. Does the teller
Did
have
you
empathy?
Know?
Empathy with the person, or are they ridiculous?
Yeah. So how does that come across here? How would you describe this tone? Is it empathetic or is it?
Well, at first when the two go in, they whisper to each other, so there's definitely not empathy there.
Yeah.
They're distancing themselves from her. And then they're astonished to see Mrs. Q talking to her.
Yeah.
Like that's...
There is something, though, I think of empathy in their action,
mm-hmm.
too, of,
sure.
of not
yeah.
not wanting to look,
not,
not wanting
to
be the ones
right.
who, you know, objectify. In some way. So there is a certain amount of empathy that I think happens simply because they've entered into her space, right? And that we, and isn't that true for us? That as soon as you've entered into a space, and what Scott was mentioning earlier, what we experienced earlier this summer, as soon as you step across the border into Palestine or wherever it is, I mean, you can no longer completely stand as objective observer, really.
Palestinians.
Yeah, no. I mean, it becomes a part of you, really.
That's a random question.
Yeah.
What's the narrator's relationship like with Kate?
They're friends.
Because it seems, I don't know, it's just really interesting that as all of this has happened, that she observes it pretty outwardly, but then she... I mean, the part that kind of caught me off guard was I'm proud to say that I never saw Kate treat anyone more politely than she did that absurd pitiful creature. And I mean, like, so even though she's observing this other thing, she's sort of observing Kate's reaction. I mean, like, I don't know if I would never ever be, like, super proud of or attentive to the way that my... I mean, her attention to Kate is... Yes.
Yeah.
Her attention to Kate is more like my attention would be to... romantic interest or to a kid, even.
A child, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
she's very sensitive to how.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There are sort of interesting levels of observation that happen throughout this particular story. That there are. Someone's watching someone watching.
Right,
someone
she's
watching
Kate.
watching
and we are, as the readers,
evaluating.
We're watching and evaluating.
Yeah.
But wouldn't you get a clue earlier in the writing as they were traveling towards the circus,
mm-hmm.
and visiting other people, and you pick up hints and nuances,
mm-hmm.
along the way, and it might help you,
mm-hmm.
To answer many of these questions, mm-hmm. that you wonder what page and a half to play.
Right. They do seem to have a fairly equal relationship as just,
mm-hmm.
friends who are traveling right now. So that is, so that is an interesting.
Yeah,
comments
that
any she makes. Well, there are lots of other
parts
of that in regional.
Yeah. So is
Mrs.
Q also the sense of they're honoring the older,
yes.
person in their party as
yeah.
well?
Yeah.
I'm not really a big Mrs. Q fan.
You don't like Mrs. Q?
That's what I do.
Why not?
Well, I mean, first off, all the backstory, so who knows where that was all in the town. I just see there's pictures all over. Chattering, telling me, and then she wanted to go in, and she wanted to go see the sideshow,
mm-hmm.
the freak show, and but then she kind of redeemed herself in the fact that she talked and made a difference in this person's life for that moment, and then kind of went back to her old ways.
Yeah, it doesn't seem as if it changes. And
excuses
herself
for why she couldn't get more involved.
Yes, exactly.
It doesn't seem to change Mrs. Q much. The encounter, right? And so I think it goes. it seems to be showing us is the important change happens for it.
Us.
Why hate?
Well, they went from hiding in a corner to interacting.
Okay. So she's drawn in and she behaves.
Very, very well.
She behaves well. Alright, you say us.
Because the next time we see someone of that dimension, I see them. Kaiser periodically on Fat Friday. It's all, pardon me?
Yeah, never mind.
Right there, it tells you something about the day that you call it that.
Well, they all call it, that's the day they come and be waiting.
Ah.
And it's, some of them, you just know they're not gonna live much longer. And you just know there's a story there somewhere. And they're all fairly young. You don't see elderly, 450 elders. And they're just busy killing themselves. Is it sex, is it suicide, is it a death wish? Has something happened? And there's a mystery, we don't know that. And so you can either ridicule them or recognize, or say, I'm glad I'm not that bad. Or how could I help this person?
Recognize their humanity.
We're caught in multiple, the very fact that we ask the questions means the author has succeeded in drawing us in. No longer a spectator, but somehow participants.
Because once you're in a relationship, you are beholden, right? Anybody else who for whom there is a significant change? It seems to me that we're supposed to see the giantess as having some kind of change. I mean, we don't get the rest of the story, so we don't, does she leave the circus and, you know, do something different with her life?
Well, I'm
Can you give us a year when this was?
1896.
Okay.
So, or thereabouts, they can close.
1877.
Oh, 1877. Oh, yeah. Okay, 1877.
Right after the Civil War.
A quote from a book that I love that deals with regional literature. It's called Writing Out of Place, and that title is really provocative, I think, in itself. But what these authors say about regionalism is that it gambles on its ability to interest readers in precisely those perspectives they may initially resist, and that may severely dislocate them by offering points of resistance to their accepted narratives of the social. Right? So the goal of it is to bring you into perspectives that you would resist. You would say, no, I'm not going into that sideshow tent. Right? And it draws you into that, and that it attempts to dislocate you from what you believe to be sort of a proper narrative, a proper story, and into something more like what this Kentucky giantess tells, the story she tells.
Would Jim Caron be considered a regional writer?
I know who she is, but I have not read her works, so I don't know.
It makes you, I've enjoyed the Winifred series, and it puts you in a small town, which would seem not very exciting to those, well, to most people. But her writings are so interesting, and she has such a does such a good job of character development to the point where you care about the person and, you know, and their situation.
Yeah.
But it's all about that particular region.
Yeah. And I think, you know, certainly this genre did not sort of die out in 1920, although some would say it did. it isn't, it's not fiction. It's sort of her memoirs and musings on what it means to live in a particular place. But it's regionalism. It has to do with place as a character. It has to do with how place shapes who we are and how we understand the world. And I think that that's largely what regionalism tries to do. But I'm interested in this idea of this dislocation, right? Which is an interesting word to use when you're talking about place. So to become dislocated isn't just about sort of, you know, having your shoulder out of joint, but to be plucked out of place, right? And what does that do to our sense of self, to our sense of who we are in relationship with other people, to our sense of where we are, to be dislocated? To
makes you hypervigilant and more perceptive and
orthodox. Okay.
When you said dislocated, and this may not be regionalism necessarily, but so any circumstance where you are dislocated is not necessarily regionalism in a story. I'm thinking about famous short story writer, but at the end the twist is that the sinners of this small town are more full of grace and love than the religious folk. And it does such a twist at the end that I was dislocated. I was dislocated. And but that isn't necessarily regionalism, but it sure was good writing.
And it sure shifts your perspective on something.
Right.
And another thing that these same writers talk about is they talk about regionalism as being a shift in the center of perception. So that regionalism is about sort of marginalized areas, right? Marginalized places and marginalized people within those places. But what regionalism attempts to do is to shift so that what was marginal is now the center, right? And I think when you're
That's what happened to those women writers.
Yeah,
by
absolutely.
The mission, because they're on the margin somewhat of the society and writing about the things that maybe the mainstream isn't interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get Chopin.
And she could be considered a regionalist writer as well, because she's writing about, you know, kind of New Orleans area and definitely showing us the locals, you know, the people there from a feminine perspective. Other observations about this piece that you want to throw out there?
Was it that this region is located that it's about?
Maine.
Maine.
Yeah, kind of coastal. Yeah. So the rest of the story is interesting too. What happens is that, so they kind of go merrily along their way right after seeing this, and they go home, and then a few days later there's a lecture in town, and it's advertised as the lecture about, I should just tell you the exact title of it, because I can't remember. The true, something about manhood. Elements of true manhood. There's going to be a lecture on the elements of true manhood. And they have Kate and the narrator and Mrs. Q have nothing else to do, so they decide to go check. So they go into this lecture hall, and the audience consists of 3 old men, 4 women, and 4 children, besides ourselves and the sexton of the church, a deaf little old man with a wooden leg. So that's the audience, right? So basically 4 old men, 4 women, and 4 children. And this lecturer just sort of goes on and on about the true elements of manhood, and some scholars think that Jewett is poking fun at Emerson, actually, with this. And he's just pontificating forever, and people are falling asleep, and he asks the sexton to take up an offer offering at the end, but he's snoring at that point. Somebody would have to wake him in order to have him go around and collect it. And so sort of the point is that she says, "You would have thought the man was addressing an enthusiastic young men's Christian association. He exhorted with fervor upon our duties as citizens and as voters." Well, a third of the audience isn't able to, well, two-thirds of the audience isn't even able to vote. So she's totally poking fun at the fact that this guy is sort of up there and paying no attention to what the audience needs or might be interested in, right? And so that's this interesting juxtaposition to their encounter with the Kentucky Giantists, and that they have an encounter. They actually have a conversation and an exchange, as opposed to somebody just yapping at them about things that have no bearing and no importance upon their lives at all. So that's the end of the story. Anything else you'd like to say?
In this particular era, and I know we're talking about a specific type of author, this is like enjoyable interaction with people, you know, it's fun reading. It's,
mm-hmm.
were there serious, right, and I don't know, I don't mean to say this isn't serious writing, but you know what, with a more serious bent, with goal or a purpose of shifting.
Sort of more philosophical or
right,
ideological.
Something like that, yes, that's what I'm saying.
Sometimes kind of kids dying.
that was
that
kind of melodrama.
That has more of a didactic purpose, and I think that these women were trying to get away from that role of having to be teachers and wanting to be more artists.
I remember that now, you're saying that.
You know, and just being able to tell a good story. But nevertheless, I think there is teaching that goes on. I mean, I think even his observation of, you know, so you have Mrs. Q sort of leading these two characters, and then the one character is making this observation about how far her friend Kate has come and her, you know. Yeah, I think there is, it still takes on sort of an educational, and even it's like these women they don't want to be maternal, but they can't seem to help it. Of sort of guiding the reader along in some way. But I also think in a lot of ways they just sort of put it out there that here are these people and I'm going to get out of the way now and let you interact with them as a reader. So
it's always a good literature. You're learning.
Yeah.
So that's sort of And so this was like put in like magazines, like you said, just period, like they would go in segments and then would say, I can't wait to see
sometimes.
What this is.
And some of these things, I mean, Jewett was published in Harper's and the Atlantic Monthly, and I mean, they were published in, you know, fairly literary, you know, high test kind of, you know, intellectual type magazines. So it wasn't even, there were some in sort of the Good Housekeeping type of things, too, Red Book, but. They were being published in serious literary journals as well. Yeah.
Well, I think that, so men were doing the same thing.
Yes.
Some of the regionalist kinds of stuff.
Oh, for sure.
And Anderson, Ohio, or whatever that name was.
Yeah.
Oh,
what
tedious.
Yeah.
But that was all about that little tiny place.
Yeah,
and
that's a little bit weird, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming. Tomorrow.
You want your pages back?